The issue that we're wrestling with is, when is a but-for cause of an injury not a proximate cause of that injury, because the test of legal cause can't be met. And we start with Crow versus Gaston on page 51. Who's missed out on a chance to do one of these cases here? Ms. Shoemaker, go ahead.
The defendant, Rickenmeyer, purchased alcohol from the defendant Oscar and gave all of the alcohol to the minor.
And so we sort of have to follow the chain here. Oscar sells to... Okay.
And
R is a minor, right? Okay.
R gives it to a group of minors.
Okay.
And R plaintiff pro socializes with this group.
Okay.
So maybe minors plus pro.
Winds up in pro's hands, yeah.
Plaintiff pro claims he did not drink any of this alcohol.
Okay.
Later in the evening, Pro accepts a ride home by an intoxicated minor.
Okay. And that's actually the more significant transfer here, that the alcohol gets transferred to, what's his name?
Fitzpatrick.
Fitzpatrick? Yeah, okay. So Fitzpatrick here, who in turn drives negligently and injures Pro. Okay, so that's the transaction of sale in violation of law, the Rettenmeyer, transfer from Rettenmeyer to Fitzpatrick, negligent driving by Fitzpatrick that injures Crow. Okay, so Crow wants to recover from whom?
From Oscar.
Okay.
Rettenmeyer.
Okay.
And there's a summary judgment in favor of the defendant.
Which one?
In favor of
both, okay. And what was the basis for the summary judgment motion? Why did Oscars claim they were entitled to summary judgment? And if you hunt for that, let's back up for a second and kind of see the big picture here. We've got chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3. We're in the middle of chapter 2. With respect to chapter 1, what would Crow have to prove vis-a-vis Oscars? If in Crow's suit against Oscars, going back to chapter 1, what does Crow have to prove? Yeah, breached a duty to him that the conduct they engaged in was negligent. What sort of evidence do we have on that point? How strong is the case for negligence? And Rettenmeyer was not of legal age and didn't present foolproof, you know, passport showing him to be of legal age. I mean, in this day and age with digital, you know, whatever, you can manufacture some pretty convincing fake ID, but Oscars isn't arguing that they weren't negligent. They can't get out on summary judgment on that basis. What about Chapter 2? What does Crow have to prove about Oscars with respect to Chapter 2?
They're saying that even if they owed a duty of care to Crow, it's not a legal cause.
Okay, and again, in Chapter 2, we divide the question of proximate cause into two different prongs. The first prong is asking whether, but for the sale of this alcohol, Crow would have been injured. Now, you could imagine some interesting but-for questions. Namely, if Oscars was, you know, one supplier out of many, it's hard to tell whether Oscars alcohol found its way into Fitzpatrick's bloodstream, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not what this is all about. It's not a multiple redundant cause issue about this combined with other factors. No, Oscar is arguing lack of legal cause. Why? What's the basis for saying it's not a legal cause of the injury if their negligence is a but-for cause of the injury? Okay, it doesn't meet the first, going back to the beginning of the chapter, Mitchell versus Gonzalez, the jury instruction that we usually give to juries, the boilerplate pattern instruction is that a proximate cause is one which, in a direct and unbroken sequence, or a natural and unbroken sequence, produces the injury, and without which the injury would not have occurred. So the but-for cause comes at the end. The first part of the test is this legal cause question. Did it occur in a direct and unbroken sequence? No, says the defendant. Whatever negligence may have occurred in this initial sale was separated from the ultimate result by this superseding cause. What is the superseding cause here? What broke the chain of causation? Fitzpatrick's... Okay, but does that ordinarily apply? If I'm a tavern, and I use that word generically, it sounds kind of low class, but it can apply to Spencer's Steakhouse serving, you know, fancy bottles of expensive wine. The point is that a defendant who serves alcohol to a person who shouldn't be served alcohol, that person gets into their car and injures somebody. Is that a basis for liability on the part of the person who sold the alcohol? Generally, yes. So what about this breaks up the chain of causation? Okay, let's sort of move over for a second. We've been talking about Oscar's liability, but in a sense, Oscar's is trying to get cover from Rettenmeier. What is Rettenmeier's argument on summary judgment? Okay. Okay. Social hosts, this is the rule we come to learn here. Social hosts owe no duty to the people who might be injured from their guests' consumption of alcohol. I throw a all-star game party and invite my friends, and I egg them on to drink, shots of tequila, knowing that they're going to drive home, knowing that they've had too much. A beastly thing to do if I had any care for humanity, but legally speaking, what's the rule with respect to me serving alcohol to my friends in a social context? No liability. So, how does that apply to R? Does R fall within that rule? Okay. So the court winds up saying he has no liability. And Oscar said, well, wait a minute. If Rettenmeier owes no duty to these people, if there is not a chain of causation that links Rettenmeier to them, you can't blame us, can you? Because we're even further back in the chain of causation than old Rettenmeier, or young Rettenmeier, as the case may be. So we shouldn't be held liable, so says Oscar. What does the court say?
Measures that Oscar could have taken, like IDing Rettenmeier, and also filling out the vendor card.
Okay.
And they sold it. So there was steps that they could have taken.
So there's a legal provision here that says if you have doubts about somebody's age, you can go through this process to kind of give yourself a little safe harbor, which they didn't do. Again, they're negligent. But how can it be that Rettmeyer, who is in a position, I mean, Oscars is running a convenience store. People come in, they buy sandwiches, they buy aspirin, they buy diapers, they buy, you know, whatever. You ring it up at the cash register. Okay, I thought Rettmeyer was of legal age. It turns out he's not, but I had no idea where this alcohol was going to go, who was going to consume it under what circumstances. Rettmeyer, by contrast, knows he's supplying this alcohol to other minors who are not, who shouldn't be having this alcohol and who are likely to use it irresponsibly, which in fact they do. As between them, Rettmeyer seems like the more culpable party. Rettmeyer's not liable. Oscars is. Rationale? How can we justify this outcome? If you're the Washington Supreme Court, you got to write this opinion. On what basis do you say Oscars is on the hook, but Rettmeyer's off the hook?
That's Oscars' business.
Okay.
I mean, that's
something that they're responsible for. As Hyman Roth says in The Godfather, it's a business that we've chosen. Yes. Oscars is in the business, and therefore a higher duty is imposed. Mr. Trujillo?
The statute itself about foreseeability of the statute that was prevented Meyer, the Oscar is in place so that the minors don't get the alcohol and then presumably provide to other minors. So the Oscar is in place. Foresee that the possibility of the minor.
Okay, so there are two different arguments to support this result. One argument is to say, while Rettmeyer may have a more direct knowledge of what's going on, social hosts have a better way of gauging their guests' consumption of alcohol, whether it's a responsible thing to offer them more or to try to get them to either stop drinking or find another way to get them where they're going. The flip side of that is that the social host is not in the business of selling alcohol, and the commercial host is. That was one rationale. The other rationale that's offered by the court is essentially to say this is the way the legislature has chosen for it to be. We started out with a rule that essentially said nobody's liable for over-serving alcohol. The legislature stepped in and said, oh yes, commercial hosts are liable, but the legislature has distinctly not chosen to make social hosts liable. And who are we, mere judges, to substitute a different rule from one the legislature, you know, to introduce something the legislature has chosen not to introduce. Not everybody's on board with this decision. What do the dissenting judges think about this problem? Judges on the Washington Supreme Court who don't find this argument persuasive, that in effect, even though the legislature hasn't explicitly made social hosts liable, the legislature hasn't written a statute immunizing social hosts, under sort of generic tort principles, social hosts would appear to owe a duty with respect to people they serve alcohol to. It's not an absolute duty, it's only a duty of reasonable care, but where somebody serving alcohol acts negligently, why is that different in kind or different from a policy standpoint than a person who's driving an automobile? We simply say as a society, you've got to do this with reasonable care. If you don't use reasonable care in conducting this activity, you are liable for the consequences. If you act in a way that you believe is reasonable under the circumstances and the jury agrees, you will face no liability. But if your conduct under the scrutiny of the jury appears to them to be reasonable, you're subject to liability in the same way that as when you operate an automobile. We're not saying serving alcohol is a bad thing. We're not saying that driving an automobile is a bad thing. It's just when you do something dangerous, you ought to do it with reasonable care. So say the dissenting judges. But again, the majority defers at this point to a legislative choice. And again, we keep asking ourselves the question, when is it that judges should recede and say, the policy merits of this question, I'm not sure I agree with, but who am I, a mere judge, to substitute my view of public policy for that of the democratically elected bodies entrusted with these matters? At other times, the courts say, gee, this is a rule we once observed, but the rule no longer makes sense unless the legislature has walled off this issue as beyond our power to change. We ought to move in and change those things and make the law conform to principles we've adopted elsewhere. So again, this whole question of is it the right thing or the wrong thing for the court to wait for the legislature to change this rule, or would it be preferable for the judges to step in and take responsibility for it? The main point about this case that I want you to get is the way in which to reinforce this message that when it comes to legal cause, it's not a technical analysis. It's a policy-driven analysis. Whether the court allows the defendant to be subject to liability is a result of the court's evaluation of the policy considerations for or against the imposition of liability. Again, those who want to make Rettenmeier liable are, in effect, saying the policy judgment weighs in favor of making social hosts accountable for their behavior. Go ahead, you know, have people to an all-star game party, serve them alcohol, but do so responsibly. By contrast, the majority says that the policy considerations weigh against imposing such a rule, reading what the legislature has done or hasn't done, looking at the phenomenon of alcohol use as something not a matter primarily of legal expertise. This is not some technical rule about, you know, settlements and the interaction of this provision of the code with that provision. It's a question about what kind of a society we want to live in. Do you want people to feel free to invite people to their houses and the responsibility is on your guest to drink responsibly? Or do you want to live in a society in which hosts who serve alcohol are, to that extent, their brother's keeper? You have to monitor what people drink, how much, and you're answerable to the victims of that overuse for what measures you took in response. And again, the majority says, wow, that's a call we ought not to make. That's a call the legislature ought to make. Yeah.
Well, it seems like in this case they pretty much stretched the definition of social host. After all, it was Rittenmeyer who received money from his friends to go in and possibly took the risk to go buy the alcohol. I mean, would that apply to somebody, say, off the street who would get paid certain money and say, hey, go in and get buy us some beer? Come out.
Well, if this was his junior achievement project, marketing 101, it might be a little bit different. But I don't think he occupies that sort of, he's not in a commercial context. Yeah, he's the oldest looking of their group, the one most voted most likely to succeed in passing for 21. but he's not in the business of supplying alcohol to minors. He's the bag man here. The larger question is the relative role of social hosts, commercial hosts, and again, the legislature has chosen to put the onus on people who sell alcohol for a living and to leave people who give it away in the position of not bearing that responsibility. That may be good public policy, it may be public policy that stinks. But again, as you're analyzing these cases, your sort of technical knowledge, your gut instincts will only carry you so far. You have to come up to the point where you say, this is a public policy matter, as I said earlier, about the sale of firearms. Should Kmart be liable for what the boyfriend does when he buys the hunting rifle and takes it home and shoots his girlfriend? Some people would say absolutely. Some people would say no way, because they have conflicting or they have different views of the best kind of public policy. So again, be a little bit cautious at this point that you want to sort of say, is this a public policy question about which people could have competing views? Todd?
What if Rittenmeyer was of age?
How would that affect the transaction here?
Well, would he still be a social host?
He would still be a social... Well, he may have some... If he were a major instead of a minor, and he gives alcohol to a minor, then he in turn may face some liability. So again, when you cross... It's more like statutory rape here. When you cross the age line, things that people can do of the same age, you can't do when there's an age differential. So an adult who gives alcohol to a minor is in trouble, whereas an adult who gives an adult alcohol or a minor who gives a minor alcohol is covered by this social host immunity. Oscars wouldn't be liable because they're entitled by law, unless the adult was intoxicated, in which case there would be liability for... selling in the same way that you can't sell alcohol to a minor, you can't sell alcohol to a major who's intoxicated. Whether they show up at your convenience store or they show up at the local tavern. Is key.
Why is there some confusion on whether or not the jury should have decided this? I mean, why does the judge seem to think that he could just decide this?
Well, again, because the public policy that has been chosen here is not a matter of saying, well, you can sell, you can be a social host as long as you're a reasonable social host. That is, I throw a party, I have a cooler full of I put two cases of beer and cover it with ice. And, people know where the beer is and people drink it and I'm not, monitoring everybody. I guess Joe got a little bit too much, and by the time he got home, that's one thing as compared to egging people on, you know, or giving it to people knowing that they're so.
But I mean,
but there's
Oscars.
What's that?
But even dismissed the case against Oscars. They weren't.
Right, but the court says that was error.
Yeah.
You know, I think what the trial judge in this sense was being logical of saying Rettenmeier's entitled to a dismissal. That's true because there are no set of facts, no matter how egregious Rettenmeier's behavior as a social host. As long as he's just a social host, he's okay. And I think what the trial judge got fooled by was the fact that Oscars seems to be able to, you know, stand under their shadow and under Rettmeyer's shadow and say, in effect, if Rettmeyer's not liable, well, how could I be? And the trial judge seemed to follow that logic erroneously again, because there is a different standard that applies to people who sell as opposed to people who give it away. Okay, so again, what I'm trying to emphasize here is the way in which you're in the world of making public policy or watching public policy get made, and be prepared for outcomes to be driven, seemingly inconsistent outcomes, if the public policy fits within the understanding of what either the court or the legislature has declared to be the way we want liability to flow. By determining who's held liable and who's not held liable, we determine, you know, the kind of society we live in. And again, people differ as to what that should look like. Okay, moving on to page 56 here, Liney versus Chestnut Motors. Now we have a more classic case of the superseding clause. And I'll take another, Ms. Kerr, go ahead.
The defendant is the garage, and the employee of the garage left the vehicle outside the garage, double parked the engine ignition unlocked, and it was stolen by an adult stranger who then drove it and hit a pedestrian.
And here's the classic lineup of these superseding clause cases, and you want to just have this sort of image in your mind. You've got the deep pocket defendant who facilitates, sort of serves up the ball, and then you've got some miscreant in the middle, thief, rapist, murderer, drunk driver, what have you, who commits a crime or other egregious kind of act and harms the plaintiff. The question is, under what circumstances should this defendant be liable to the plaintiff? What's the defendant's argument as to why the defendant shouldn't be held liable? Okay. And why is it relevant whether they could or couldn't foresee this? Okay. To some extent, we may get into the what we'll come to in the Pulse Grab case, which is this whole notion about, you know, the relationship between foreseeability and the duty of care. I don't want to quite go there yet. But there's a different way to argue that because the defendant couldn't foresee it, the defendant can't be held liable to the plaintiff. And why?
Was it negligent?
Well, that's st- still sort of the Paul's graph actually reverting to chapter 1. Making a chapter 2 argument out of it.
That because it wasn't that they left it there, it was that the thief was needed.
Yeah, we're getting closer there. The difficulty with the way you formulate it is that you're going toward the definite article there, the proximate cause. A cause. Why is it not? Certainly the thief's criminal behavior is a cause. No one's going to, and it by all means is the most important cause, but can the garage's negligence be another cause? All it has to be is a proximate cause. Why, says the defendant, is it not a proximate cause? Yes, the thief's negligence is a superseding cause that breaks the chain of causation. Remember that what we have to have between the defendant's negligence and the plaintiff's injury is this direct and continuous sequence, unbroken by any, you know, intervening cause. And now we get into sort of the land of metaphors, and we have to figure out what sort of relationship do we need, or by contrast, at what point can the defendant say this thing has not just been stretched, it's been broken. We no longer can trace a continuous sequence from this negligent act to the plaintiff's injury has been broken by this criminal act. And the original criterion that you used to say that the garage owner shouldn't be held liable is, tell me again, you said it earlier. Your first answer to why the defendant shouldn't be held liable is... Your first answer was that it wasn't foreseeable. Remember that?
Right, yeah. But he didn't know that he could actually get somebody in the car.
And the reason why foreseeability is relevant here, as well as when we talk about in the Paul Trapp case, is that something which is unforeseeable doesn't sound like a natural and continuous sequence. It's a sort of who would have thunk it notion that... It's, again, breaks the chain of causation. It's a sort of random occurrence. I don't want to confuse you by saying this is Lightberry versus Sugar Notch, but it bears a similar relationship in that the defendant is saying there's no natural and continuous sequence. This is just sort of random occurrence. Yeah, I happened to leave the keys in the car. It happened to be that the thief came along and stole it, but what's that got to do with anything? So, legal cause, again, carries with it the notion that between the defendant's negligence and the plaintiff's injury is this natural and continuous sequence. If that's not true, if the causal chain has been broken by some completely out of the blue, who would have thunk it kind of event, the defendant can say, why should I be held liable just as I was in the wrong place at the wrong time? The person you're really after is this car thief. Or Kmart would say, the guy you're really after is the boyfriend who shot his girlfriend. He's the one that ought to pay for that injury. We're just, you know, a spectator in all of this. Okay, now, what does the court hold in Liney versus Chestnut Motors? Is this or is this not a cause of the injury? They say it's not. And again, they agree with this argument that an accident resulting from the theft of a car is unforeseeable. Who would have thunk it? Now, by contrast, we have this case, Ross versus Hartman, which is actually earlier in time, as it turns out. It's a little bit puzzling why the court in Liney versus Chestnut Motors didn't take advantage of Ross versus Hartman, but maybe Ross versus Hartman is different. Maybe there's a different dynamic at work in Ross versus Hartman that justifies a different outcome. Anybody tell us about Ross versus Hartman here? Mr. Christopoulos. Okay. So the facts of this case sound functionally equivalent to the facts in Blaney versus Chestnut Motors, right? Defendants, this deep pocket, negligently leaves the vehicle in a condition where it's easy to be stolen. It does get stolen. Plaintiff gets injured. Plaintiff now wants to recover from the deep pocket defendant. What does the court say is the proper disposition of that claim? It will first tell us what the trial court did. Yes. So the trial court agreed, in effect, with the same analysis as we had in Liney, although, again, it's earlier. But what does the Court of Appeals say? Let's think about this for a moment. The appellate court places reliance upon the statute. What does the statute help us with? Why is the statute important in our analysis? Okay, that solves our Chapter 1 problem. But does it solve our Chapter 2 problem, which is, however negligent this conduct may be, it can't be the source of liability to the plaintiff unless you can trace the causal chain and overcome the argument by the defendant that the thief is a superseding cause. Why is the thief not a superseding cause of the injury? Why didn't the thief break the chain of causation? Why is the statute relevant to that inquiry, not just to the inquiry about whether the defendant was negligent? Mr. Middleton? How do we know that? How do we know that? Or we may simply be using a kind of logical inference. Why do we pick out, I mean, when you think about what could be the other reasons why there would be a statute that says, don't leave your keys in the car, or leave, you know, in this case it was leave it unlocked, or otherwise make it available to a thief to be stolen. Mr. Christopoulos? How do we know that, though? They may say, in order to reduce the injuries and deaths resulting from stolen cars, but even if it didn't say that, yes, Ms. DeNamer? Yeah. Okay. And again, one reason may be we're sick of spending police resources chasing down stolen cars. That could be the more kind of, you know, this is not about the risk of car thieves running over people. This is about, hey, we don't like having to spend, you know, if you can prevent a theft, better that you prevent the theft than we have to run around using resources to track down thieves. But we don't have a similar kind of prohibition that says you've got to lock your doors, you know, at home to prevent burglaries. You've got to, you know, there's no statute that prevents you from being a victim of theft. There's nothing that says, you know, anyone who leaves his wallet on a park bench is committing a misdemeanor. Anyone who leaves his bicycle. No, there's no rule against that. But there is a rule against people leaving their cars or vehicles in a condition that allows them to be stolen. And we can infer from that, the court makes a reasonable inference or assumption about the statute, that the purpose of this statute was to reduce the risk of injury to people like the plaintiff. The plaintiff was the intended beneficiary of this statute. And for that reason, we say that this is not just a random occurrence, but rather that the legislature foresaw this, and therefore the defendant is under a legal duty to foresee it. The defendant cannot, because of this statute, say, gee, I never imagined that a car thief would have stolen the car. Or, even if it were stolen, it never occurred to me that the thief would use it in a careless manner. Which, by the way, was the rationale for the previous case. The judge in Liney versus Chestnut Motors says, well, even if you could foresee the thing would be stolen, you have no reason to think that car thieves would be any more careless than the average driver. Oh, yeah? That seems like a pretty stupid observation to make. What do we know about car thieves? You know, they're not particularly thoughtful people in the beginning. They're probably in a hurry to escape detection. They're unfamiliar with the controls of the automobile. There's some reason why they can't afford to buy their own and are going to risk the penalties for theft to steal it. Having them behind the wheel is a pretty scary proposition. And whereas in the previous case, in Liney versus Chestnut Motors, we expect the judge to make this observation on their own, in Ross versus Hartman, it's the legislature that makes that explicit. The legislature says, in effect, foresee it. Foresee the kinds of injuries that could occur from allowing your car to be stolen and prevent it. Then, when the plaintiff says the defendant's negligence happened in a direct and, you know, unbroken sequence, the defendant is in a hard place to say, well, gee, I never imagined this. This is unforeseeable. The legislature, in a sense, puts them on notice of the need to foresee it. Now, again, you need to kind of distinguish the question of whether the legislature is only addressing the issue of negligence or whether, at the same time, the legislature is addressing the question of causation. If they're also addressing the issue of causation and saying this kind of injury is the reason why we're making this conduct unlawful, then you can say for that reason they're going to be responsible. Now, I have two examples of this problem showing up on an exam. The first example I have is, and both these are taken from real cases, the first example is a guy who shows up at an agricultural product supply dealer and is looking for rat poison. And they say to him, do you have a license under the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act? We can only sell rat poison to licensed applicators. And you, my friend, are not a licensed applicator. Get thee hence. So he leaves that place, goes to another place, says, do you have any rat poison? And they say, yeah, how much do you need? And they sell it to him. He goes home, takes the rat poison, puts it in his wife's coffee, kills her. Her estate, the children, sue the seller of the rat poison, who sold it to the murderer who killed their mother. Is the seller of the rat poison liable? Yes, no, maybe?
No.
What were the conditions of the legislation that required the...
That's a very good question. If we knew the purpose of the statute, we would be in a better position to figure out whether this kind of injury was one of the kinds of injuries the legislature had in mind when it said you may not sell rat poison to someone other than a licensed applicator. Now, what would you guess would be the primary target of this legislation? What was the primary harm the legislation was designed to prevent? Mr. Gallert?
To prevent accidental misuse.
Right. Amateurs, you know, spraying this willy-nilly, messing up the environment, you know, poisoning, you know, water systems and other places because they're not properly trained and they just, you know, are oblivious, causing harm directly and indirectly to the environment, directly to people, exposing them to hazardous chemicals, and indirectly by poisoning the environment and making us clean this up and so forth. Did their purpose also include the potential for use by criminals who wanted to use rat poison as a means of, say, mass terrorism, or, in this case, individual criminal conduct? If they didn't have that purpose in mind, then we can't do for that statute or with that statute what we did with the statute in Ross versus Hartman. Say the legislature has told you, oh seller of rat poison, be on the alert. Trial court granted summary judgment to the defendant. That summary judgment was affirmed on appeal. Now, was there an argument that the defendant was negligent? Negligent as a matter of law? Yes. Was there an argument that the statute supplied the foreseeability which forms the basis of legal cause? There's an argument. It just didn't work. And again, from an analytical standpoint, from the lawyer's standpoint, representing either the plaintiff or the defendant, one of the thoughts you should have in mind is, can the defendant successfully argue that the chain of causation was broken by this superseding cause? And the trial court thought it had been broken. Now, one of the things I'm going to suggest to you as a rule of thumb in figuring out whether something, well, yeah, I'll give you this test and then I'll give you another example of it. Two questions you want to ask. First, how foreseeable? As you're standing there at the counter looking at this guy who's asking you for rat poison, how foreseeable is it? Yeah, she's really driving you crazy, huh? You know, how foreseeable is it that he's going to take it and go home and murder his wife? As compared to, you know, you're trying to figure out whether to leave the keys in the car, and the question is it foreseeable, gee, if I don't take the keys out of this car, secure it from being stolen, some thief's going to come along and run over somebody. You run a Holiday Inn. How foreseeable is it that if you're careless about the way you hand out keys, somebody comes in and says, you know, dripping from the hot tub and says, you know, I can't find my key to 728. Can you give me a new key? Yeah, here's 728. They run off, and it turns out they're, you know, a thief or you know, they hurt somebody in the process. How foreseeable is it from the defendant's standpoint that if I fail to use reasonable care in this thing with which I'm entrusted, whether it's, you know, keys to a motel room or rat poison or a car that's sitting waiting for repair, how foreseeable is it that my carelessness in the use of this thing is going to result in injury to a third party? The more foreseeable it is, the more likely the court will say, not a superseding cause, this is something for which you are responsible. Second question is, how disproportionate the culpability. Defendant negligently sells a rodenticide in violation of the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. Bad thing. Compared to murder, I don't think you could get a more disproportionate kind of culpability. Remember that the effect, if we say the seller is liable for the murder of this woman, the family, the estate, is entitled to a full damage recovery. The girlfriend who gets shot by the hunting rifle sold by Kmart, should Kmart reimburse her for all of the injuries she suffered from being shot? To the extent that the small level of culpability has been overmatched by this criminal act, the defendant can say, in effect, remember we're talking legal cause here. Is it fair to hold me responsible? My little teeny act of negligence here gets completely blown out of proportion by the criminal act of somebody else. You're not going to make me pay that whole thing, are you? The more disproportionate, the better the defendant's argument. The more the culpability begins to kind of match, the more equitable it seems, the more sensible it seems to say to that defendant, you are responsible. Go back to Oscars again. Oscars, the commercial vendor of alcohol, sells alcohol, his friends pass it, I mean, the purchaser passes it around with his friends, they get in cars, they cause an automobile accident. Tragic, you know, so forth and so on. Again, the relative culpability between the adult who makes money selling alcohol and the kids who use it irresponsibly, that's a fairly even match, I would say. At least compared to violation of some federal regulation and murder. So again, as your rule of thumb here, the more foreseeable, the better for the plaintiff. Well, let's put it the other way around. Because both of these would then favor the defendant. How unforeseeable? The more unforeseeable it is, the better for the defendant. The more disproportionate it is, the better for the defendant. And then, obviously, the other way around. So as you look at these cases, I think you would have seen in the rat poison case the lack of foreseeability and the disproportionate culpability as kind of warning signs. This doesn't look real good for the plaintiff. And would have, I think, led you... Now, on the exam, I didn't expect people to call it when I thought it might have been a jury question. I thought the appellate court might have said to the trial judge, no, don't bounce this out on summary judgment. Give it to the jury. Let the jury wrestle with whether they think this proximately caused the injury or not. But at least, whether you're plaintiff or defendant in the rat poison case, you spot the issue. You identify this is a potential clean winner for the defendant. Even if you think the defendant's chances of getting out on summary judgment are not all that good, remember this is the ball game. If I win on this issue as the defendant, I've won the whole case. It doesn't matter how negligent they find me to be. It doesn't matter how extensive the plaintiff's damages are. If I didn't cause the injury, I don't pay a dime. So the stakes on these legal cause issues are very high because it's a potential, walk-off home run in the bottom of the ninth. One swing of the bat and the ball game's over. Mr. Ortiz. Yeah, if you're in an intersection collision case and your client ran a red light and hit somebody, I'm not going to file a motion saying as a matter of law I'm entitled to summary judgment because this isn't a legal cause. Well, you may win on other grounds, but you're never going to win a legal cause argument on that. The place to argue on summary judgment is where you're the deep pocket defendant, you've set up some criminal act, some guy who hit somebody else over the head with a pool cue, and it's the plaintiff who's suing you. Then we say, superseding cause. Now let me just talk terminology here for a second. The courts use two different terms, not always consistently. I'd like you to use these terms in ways that reflect the operative significance. Here's what I mean. A superseding cause is one that displaces the original cause. The seller of rat poison is a cause which is superseded by the felonious act of the murderer. When you call something a superseding cause, it breaks the chain of causation. An intervening cause, on the other hand, merely participates in but doesn't replace. You can have an intervening cause, that's okay, doesn't break the chain of causation, it just adds to the fun. So if Dean Morrissey walked in and said, I've got a really interesting case I want to tell you about, he could intervene in my class without displacing me. I would still be your professor. But if Dean Morrissey walked in and said, thanks, David, I want to tell them about this. Here's some Xeroxing I'd like you to do. He would supersede me. So when you use the term, as I say, the courts sometimes refer to an intervening cause as though it would break the chain of causation. An intervening cause can rise to that level, and sometimes it's sort of hard to see exactly how it's, how the two things are interacting. But again, when we're looking for a superseding cause, the defendant's always looking for a superseding cause to break the chain of causation and extinguish the defendant's liability. The plaintiff always wants to characterize it as an intervening cause that, sure, yeah, it intervened, it participated. I'm not saying Morrissey wasn't here. I'm just saying that he was a participant rather than a replacement who broke the previous, chain of causation. So, again, if you've got this image in your mind and you can see it in the exam and you can give the argument the defendant would make and recognize when it's going to help you and when it's really, kind of a waste of paper because there's nothing between the defendant's negligence and the injury that's particularly, surprising. There's no criminal intentional act. You can make that distinction and recognize here the arguments the parties are going to make, then you're doing well on this part of it. How it turns out, again, depends upon how people evaluate these criteria. Are they convinced that this action was foreseeable? Are they convinced that the defendant deserves to bear the consequences of what somebody else did? Okay, I run a Holiday Inn. I hand somebody the key to 728. He's standing there dripping in a towel. I'm not going to ask him for ID. Well, duh. You know, it turns out it's a very clever disguise for somebody to get a key to a room where there's all kinds of, you know, valuables that are gone because of your carelessness in not exercising reasonable care. So again, making the proper evaluation is what it's all about. Okay, let's take a break, and we'll come back and talk about Paul's breath.